Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. We have some special guests live in our studio. And first of all, I do want to say that Alaska really is, of all places in our country, the mother lode of great stories. And perhaps part of it could be because it has such a rich history in the fishing industry. Old canneries today that are now like ghost towns in many parts of our state, you know, still have great stories to tell. And we're going to hear a few of them with a new exhibit that's opening at the Alaska State Museum tonight. And joining us now, we have Addison Field. He's the chief curator of the Alaska State Museum. And Katie Ringsmuth, she's the state historian and kind of, I would say, the mother of this project, the mother of the mother load. And we also have Dave Thomas here from Sentinel Coffee, and we'll tell you why Dave is here a little later on, because coffee does figure into this story, and we can all relate to coffee. So, Katie, you know, I have to give a little bit away here that when this story or this project was just hatching, this was years down the road, but you were giving me and other reporters a tour of a cannery in South Naknek, and it was like a big ghost town. It was amazing, and you had this idea that you were going to salvage pieces of this old cannery and exhibit it, and it's taken years, but here you are.
Yeah, and here we are, and we're at the end of this big journey, and you're right, you know, in 2015, the owner of the Diamond Inn and Cannery at South Naknek, Trident Seafoods, we had heard that they were going to mothball the cannery. 130 years the cannery ran, and Trident, you know, had decided it was, you know, too old, and they were shutting it down. And several kind of fish historians and I, Bob King, Tim Troll, Angelie Grantham, you know, we really thought we needed to do something to recognize the importance of the commercial fishery and specifically the canneries in Alaska. And so we thought that we'd try to get the cannery listed on the National Register, which we did. It was listed in August of this year. And one of the other ways was to really share with the public the story of the canneries and the story of work and mug up through the exhibit. And thank goodness we Addison and I had coffee one day, and this is the result. So
coffee is central to
coffee
this
is central. That's why it's called mug up.
Mug up. And it just for the uninitiated, what does the term mug up mean?
Yeah, well, you know, I tried to investigate that historically, and it's tough. You know, the Atlantic fishermen used to, you know, with the sway of the ship, they'd always have to lift their mug up. That's one origin story. Another is that, you know, what you do in drinking coffee, you lift your mug up to your mouth to drink it. So that's the one I'm going with. But it's coffee break in cannery parlance. And every cannery had a mug up, usually at 10 o'clock in the morning, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, at 9 o'clock at night. And on those really long processing days, you'd have a midnight meal, which was a mug up. So your whole work clock revolved around the mug up schedule.
It was the milestone. You know, it could be, too, that a lot of times mugs are face down, right, so that they don't get dirty. So when you turn it up, you're –
Excellent. Yeah, that's another one. I'll use that.
Can I, too, be a fish historian?
Yes, you can be a fish historian, too, Rhonda.
Well, Addison, you curate a lot of different exhibits, but this one must be a real pleasure just because it's so rich.
Absolutely. There's stories upon stories layered in the gallery over there, and it's just very exciting to be at the opening point for this. We're open for First Friday tonight, starting at 4, going to 7. And the show will be here running at the Alaska State Museum through October the 8th.
So one of the things that is so special about this, though, is that you were able to take some of the equipment from that cannery. And I remember the first tour you gave us through these dilapidated buildings, wondering what in the heck is that stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, well, actually, it was a huge effort, and part of just identifying what some of the older objects were, thanks to Facebook, I'd have a question, I'd post it, and it would be amazing, all of the expertise and wisdom that lies in the social media sphere. But, once we were able to identify objects, again, it was Trident Seafoods. They stepped up. They offered to give us a container, and we filled it. And we had a weekend this summer, and we went out with a crew and filled a 20-foot container full of objects from the cannery. And many of those objects are going to be on display tonight. So, and all the way till October. So it was, some of those things are big and heavy. And we pulled it off, including a Bristol Bay three-wheeler.
Well, they were heavy duty because they did heavy duty work. I mean, I can imagine that those canneries were just full of noise, of clanging and banging.
Yeah. Alan Boris called Alaska salmon canneries the industrial revolution of the North, and it absolutely was. And whether you're talking about the industry, the mass production of canning, salmon, and also the marketing. There's a fantastic story the museum staff put together on the how to eat canned salmon, which really looks at how the Madison Avenue attracted a nation of consumers and taught them how to eat fish.
So, Addison, what do you think is remarkable about this exhibit, just from the perspective of having curated other exhibits?
The objects that are in there, I think, are pretty amazing. I think about when you walk into that gallery, the first thing you're looking at is the Cushman. And that came all the way from Bristol Bay to be in this exhibit here tonight. And it's integral to that story of mug-up. It was that object around which that coffee culture we're talking about revolved. And the stories I've heard of that from Katie and the stories that have been included in the interpretation of the exhibit just really helped me understand how what a microcosm it was out there in the canneries.
So Dave Thomas is here from Sentinel Coffee. Dave, congratulations. I guess you're the official mug of coffee supplier.
The official supplier of mug up coffee. Yeah, it's really, really attracted me when Katie came to me and asked me if I could make a blend for them. I really like the concept of, a lot of the people that were working in the factories were immigrants, and they all kind of came from all over the world. And one place where they came together was on their coffee breaks, and that really spoke to me. I mean, I feel like a lot of my friendships over the years have kind of culminated in coffee breaks at work and things like that, and working in factories or the hospitality industry, and just seeing all the stories that they're showing of all these people that from all over the world coming together and working in one place, but then really kind of meeting each other during their coffee breaks. And I think that's what coffee for me means, is it's this cultural coming together that coffee, everybody kind of sits together and comes together over a cup of coffee. And so I made a blend that I kind of did a little bit of research and found out which coffees were kind of being imported at that time in that era that were kind of popular. And so I kind of made this blend to kind of speak to that flavor profile and kind of resonate with that era.
I wonder who had the best coffee, because basically you had groups of immigrants come and they pretty much shared housing with their immigrant group and also dining halls. They didn't really intermix much, and that's kind of except at the coffee breaks. But I'm curious, Katie, I wonder who had the best coffee, the Italians maybe?
Well, the Fishermen's Union sued because, knowing their union agreements with the canneries, they said, you got to stop watering down our coffee. So, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Carville Zimmern, who is the longtime winterman there, who was here this weekend, he had such a great line about the coffee break and mug up. He said, you know, it's just that act of drinking coffee. And he said, that's how memories get shared. And I think that is, you know, just that act of doing it every day and how we just pass down that experience and how important it is to just come together through this experience of hard work. And, you know, it does show that we are all in this together.
Well, Carville Zimmern, you mentioned, is a winter man. And basically, his family has wintered over at the Diamond N.N. Cannery for generations, maybe three generations, I think.
Yep. Yeah, his grandfather, his father, and his brother were wintermen. And then Carville took on that job. And when you think of the cannery being 130 years old, you know, this is a wooden structure full of oil and diesel, you know, the fact that those buildings are still there and they still tell those stories, they still hold that history for us, you know, that's a testimony to the local residents who cared for these buildings, you know, pretty much 11 months out of the year.
Well, what's interesting about some of Carville's stories, and I hope people get a chance to hear some of them, is that in the day of his grandfather, they didn't have any refrigeration. So in the wintertime, they had to go he was plenty busy, right? As the winterman, they had to go get chunks of ice, frozen ice, and stockpile them underground and cover them with sawdust so that they could refrigerate food. And maybe, you know, one of the things I think it's hard to appreciate is that the Bristol Bay salmon season today is about a month or so, if that.
Right, yeah.
But back then, how long was it and why?
Well, the salmon still ran the same back then. It just took them longer to get there and get back. So, it was a huge production. And, of course, you know, the superintendents would be planning all year round because, especially in the old days, if you have one bad season and you miss it, or, you know, your crew isn't ready or your fishing boats aren't ready to go, that's it. You're done. So, yes, they have more technology. Yes, they can get their speed, you know, faster. But, you know, those Bristol Bay fish still keep coming, and they're coming, they're expected to have the largest run in on record this summer. So, you know, it's not forgotten history. It's still happening out there.
But, you know, I think we're, even though this exhibit comes from a Bristol Bay cannery, it seems to tell the story of a lot of canneries in that there was a multiracial workforce.
Yeah, right.
And like I said, some of the things back in the day almost seem sort of racist, that people were in separate housing, you know, the Filipinos in one housing area, and they ate. And Alaska Natives didn't work in the canneries, although those communities hosted the canneries, probably because they were subsistence fishing in part. But do you think that this bears examination?
Oh, sure. And that's what actually makes this cannery important, even as a historic relic, because it was 130 years old. So it allows us access into understanding those relationships, the segregation that existed, you know, and certainly the sexism that occurred as well. And also the policies that were instituted that created integration and empowerment of people. So, it's really kind of important because those buildings tell a history and a story you're absolutely right, that deserve that recognition.
Well, I have to ask you about one machine that got my curiosity because you were giving reporters this tour and you said that's the chink machine.
Yeah.
The name of that
is pretty horrifying.
It's a racist slur today to call someone Chinese a chink. But why was it called the chink machine, and did the Chinese mind?
Well, I'm sure they didn't like it. but I think it's also important for us because it's a machine that, you know, it memorializes the thousands of Chinese workers who were absolutely instrumental in this industry, especially in its early stages, where they did everything. You know, they didn't just process the fish. They made the cans, right? They soldered them. They did, and this is a business that if you do it wrong, it could kill people. So the Chinese weren't just coolies. They were highly skilled. They were, you know, and so people do remember the Chinese because of that machine. And it is terrible, a terrible name. But
is it in the,
it should not be forgotten. No. Well, you know, we were kind of thinking about getting other museums have had that machine displayed. But what we really wanted to do is not talk so much about the machines, but the people. Because with the Chinese Exclusion Act and the combination of that machine, the Chinese aged out. And then came Mexicans, and then came African Americans and Puerto Ricans. And most people don't know anything about them. And so we felt that those stories needed to be remembered and told. And so hopefully that allows, you know, Alaska Studies teachers and others to kind of drill a little deeper into these stories, and we can get some of these experiences back into our historic narrative, because these are the people who contributed to one of Alaska's most significant industries, and they really matter.
Well, one of the things that I'd like you to back up a bit, because you mentioned the Chinese Exclusion Act. What was that? And yet Alaska, they were excluded from the labor force, but Alaska still had them in their canneries. How did that
well,
happen?
Well, it was a Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882. It was a response to anti-Chinese sentiments, especially on the West Coast. The United States actually brought Chinese into the country to help build the transcontinental railroads. So many Chinese had ended up on the West Coast. You have, you know, labor issues, depressions. You know, the Chinese became a target of you know, labor and violence on the West Coast. So Congress passes this law that says that Chinese can no longer enter the country, and so they were given a chance: you can stay or go. And that was instituted for, you know, until the 1950s. So,
wow.
Yeah. So what happens is that the Chinese simply aged out, and they needed to bring in more. So you have Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, and then ultimately the Filipinos who unionize and kind of break that labor cycle.
Well, one thing I wonder about too is in Alaska, all over Alaska, like in Bristol Bay, for example, you have many prominent Yupik and Japanese families, and in Whaling, you have some people that have some Japanese blood and some New Yorker blood.
Yeah.
If that's a race of its own, but I mean, you have here in Juneau, you know, you have what is known as the Klinkapino.
Uh-huh.
A lot of imagine that the fisheries brought the Filipino community here. So we have a lot of mixed heritages in Alaska, probably because of the fisheries.
Oh, sure.
And how does that affect us, I think, in the big picture?
You want to take that?
I don't know. We certainly have a very diverse state, and I think that it makes us a special place, and adds, you know, another layer to the richness of our culture here. Just before we came into this room, we were talking a little bit about cultural tourism, and this exhibit might be one of the only times that many people coming to Juneau will have to see a cannery, to see what not only what it looks like through the objects which we have next door, but also to hear the noises and the sounds.
That is such a huge story, but we are out of time to go. So we want to thank Addison Field, the chief curator of the Alaska State Museum, Katie Ringsmith, state historian, and Dave Thomas with Sentinel Coffee. Thanks for being here with us.